We have a pretty good slate here. We're starting a little late. I'm going to try to adhere to the schedule as best as I can. I'm Vincent Pilote, by the way, if anybody's wondering who is this person yapping at them. And that's all you need to know. And let me get busy with this first session, which is in your guide, it's called the AAA session. AAA used to stand for Associated Audio Archives. Garrett Bowles will tell you what it stands for now and some other things. That sounds good. And let me give you the introduction. Garrett Bowles, who is the chair of the AAA, got his PhD at Stanford University, MLS at University of California, Berkeley. He's been past president of ARSC, and as I said earlier, he is currently the chair of the AAA. Sue Stinson, who's sitting on the end there, you should all know her, currently curator of the Belfer Audio Laboratories and Archive at Syracuse University, and she's been active in ARSC since 1982. Jerry Gibson, who's listed in your program, unfortunately couldn't make it, but he sent the fax, which Ted Sheldon, past president of ARSC, an all-around swell guy, has agreed to do in some way, manner, or shape. It should be very interesting.
Watch it, Mike.
The young lady sandwiched between Sue and Ted is Brenda Nelson Strauss, who, again, you should all know. She's been around for a while here. Has been director of the Rosenthal Archives of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra since 1989, where she is in charge of the collection, preservation, and access of over 2,000 linear feet of administrative records, music, and audiovisual materials. She has served in several ARSC committees and is past second vice president, program chair. Brenda also holds memberships in Music Library Association, Society of American Archivists, and Association of Moving Image Archives, I believe that is. And of course, she is currently co-chair of the ARSC Awards with me. And thank God she's there. Okay, take it away, you guys. You got it.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Am I coming in on a mic? Okay. I wanted to start off first by telling you, what AAA is and what it's about to become, or what it has become, and I'll talk a bit about that. And then we've got basically three reports of based on activities that AAA has been involved in. And then I'm hoping that there will be some time at the end of this session where I would like to hear from you in the audience. And so I'd like you to begin thinking now about how you would like to participate in AAA, and how would you like, what kinds of things would you like to see AAA doing? Because AAA is changing its focus very significantly. First, I suppose I should tell you that what AAA is not, and if any of you are here for the Association of Amateur Accordionists, you should probably leave now. But what AAA has been is the Association of Audio Archives. And the title reflects the kind of focus that we have had. We began as a group focused on institutions. And we started in 1974 when four of us got together to try to solve one of the big issues that we all had, which was the cataloging of 78 RPM recordings. And the four that we that got together were representatives from Stanford, that was me, Library of Congress, which was Jerry Gibson, and New York Public Library, David Hall, and we met at Yale University with Richard Warren. And the reason we met there was because we were under the impression that Yale University had cataloged its 78 RPM collection. And we knew it was smaller than the other three, but we thought it would be a very useful place to start. Well, it turned out that, in fact, it wasn't cataloged. And so we began talking about how we could go about putting it together. We put together a grant proposal to the National Endowment for the Humanities for a planning grant, and added Syracuse University and Toronto University to us and started working on how to catalog 78 RPM recordings. As a result of that, the ARS cataloging rules were developed. But at the very end of that planning study, we decided that the most cost-effective way of cataloging recordings was to develop a, or was to use a microfilming system, which has since become RDI. And with that system, the labels were microfilmed of all the recordings, and then the key punch operators basically sat down and transcribed that information into an index. And that was, in fact, the second grant that that AAA got, which came from the National Endowment for the Humanities and resulted in the Rigler Deutsch Index. After that was finished, AAA focused then on preservation, but also trying to clean up the RDI. And you know, developing, simply copying information from labels with untrained people, two kinds of errors creep in. One is the errors, of course, that already exist on the labels, and the other is key punch errors. And the key punch errors were tried, the idea was to try to reduce those very much by having two different people key the same thing, and then you would compare it and take the best. But still, you know, there are still errors. So AAA then started working on preservation, and it was still this same group of, Stanford, Yale, Syracuse, New York Public Library, and Library of Congress. About 1987, it was decided, okay, they worked on a preservation grant and put out the preservation report, which is a very hefty one, which I hope you've seen, and it's available from ARSC. In 87, it was decided to expand the membership to other institutional, other institutions, and so our AAA almost doubled, or certainly doubled in size at that point. And the idea was that we were to work on a handbook for archivists. And we had a grant from NEH again to do that. We had put together a grant which we were submitting to NEH to do a handbook, but that was not funded. And AAA began to lose its focus. Over the last few years, we've been working on a number of different kinds of projects, including an attempt to edit the tapes that were made of the preservation of the seminar.
The
Peabody-sponsored seminar, and other sorts of projects as well, some of which you're going to hear about here. In 1997, after having talked about it for a while, we began to very seriously talk about how we could change the focus of AAA. And in the 97 and 98 meetings, after much discussion, we decided that the name should no longer be the Associated Audio Archives, but rather the Associated Audio Archivists, and that no longer would there be such an institutional focus. The institutional focus was almost was actually a legal setup, because the idea was that that the representatives from the various institutions would be official representatives, and this meant that for decisions to be made, there had to be votes, and it had to be pretty much unanimous, and that, not always, but usually. Is there some water in the house, perchance? We've attempted to try to change this focus. We would like to involve anybody who wants to come in, although our principal focus is going to be towards towards institutional archives, not private archives. But if private archivist who wants to come in and listen to meetings and wants to participate is perfectly welcome. If people have ideas of projects they think we should work on and would be interested in working on these projects, then propose them, and we'll talk about it. If it turns out that a group of institutions wants to get together to put together a grant proposal and do some special kind of project that would benefit those institutions, AAA can continue to be a forum to discuss those things, but also can be sort of the umbrella to help you do that. So what we're trying to do is to really very much broaden the kinds of things we do. We developed a set of goals. I'd like to quickly read them. One is to develop a clearinghouse on information on preservation, cataloging, and new technology. Another is to define standard practice archival preservation techniques. Another is to develop and expand relationships with the Arts Technical Committee, the Discographic Access Committee, and the Education Committee, and other committees as necessary. Another is to, in cooperation with the Arts Education Committee, develop education and training seminars for sound archivists. Promote an open environment for discussion of institutional archival issues. We're to develop an understanding of our environment, which means what is our position in the worldwide database of sound recordings? How do we focus on preserving our unique holdings? How do we function within our environment? We need to understand the change in the environmental, the archival environment as well. We also think we should undertake some computer projects, for instance, the updating of the 1986 preservation survey and other kinds of projects. And finally, we want to promote the dissemination of information about archival practices through an active publication program. So I'd appreciate it if you would all think about these goals, and if there are other things that we ought to be doing, and again, how you would like to participate. As I say, it's basically open to anybody who wants to participate. So we'll come back to that at the end of this session. Now, I'd like to introduce Sue Stinson, who is going to talk about the New York Sound Recordings Workshops.
Well, this workshop builds on this idea that we had talked about on AAA for a number of years to develop a workshop, a traveling package seminar that could be done in various locations around the country to disseminate information on the care and feeding of sound recordings to librarians and historical societies and other places where they have some sound recordings. Or collectors want to gather and learn more about best practices and to share information. And it was pretty hard for us to do this in AAA. For one thing, we're spread out all over the country. We are bogged down with a great many other tasks in our jobs. And so this sort of has languished, but we talked about it at Syracuse, and we found that there was a potential for getting a grant to support this effort from the New York State Program for the Preservation of Library Materials. It's right up this alley. So we applied for it, and this is over 2 years ago that we started hatching this. We applied for it and got it, a small grant. It was about, it was just under $17,000, I think, to put our heads together and come up with the kinds of information that we could put together as handouts to provide a teaching packet and AV illustrations, actual samples of various formats of recordings and slides of things that don't travel well and things that would be very hard to describe just in words, and to just create this package and then hand it over to ARSC, to AAA or whoever, so that it's a done thing and can be carried forth by this organization. And so we rounded up the obvious suspects in the New York State area of Suzanne Stover and Jim Farrington, Don McCormick, Mark Tollison, Vince Pilote, who became an honorary New Yorker for this. We also we had Ted Sheldon on board as well, and Les Waffen, who did not come to planning meetings but sent materials and had a good deal of input that way. We spent several sessions just planning the direction we were going to go in and trying to develop an agenda and decide what materials to include, how long should this be, and then schedule a series of workshops to test this whole package. So we divided our group took on various responsibilities for different topics that would be covered during the day, and did a lot of writing and rewriting and sharing back and forth to make sure that we were covering everything at least once. And I contacted the regional library councils around New York State. We scheduled the actual day. It was a one-day event, and found for the most part these regional councils were very gracious hosts. I developed a flyer that would be sent out to the mailing lists for all of these New York State councils so that we would reach as many people as we could in the field. We had questionnaires that were handed out at the end of the day to evaluate the program so that we could tell how well we were doing with what we had prepared in terms of answering questions and giving them information they needed. And I came up with the idea of doing a three-ring binder because we think this is important information and would have some kind of a durable way to collect information. And with a binder, it's adaptable to new versions of material you can add to it. And this went over very well. I have to say that the people that attended were tickled pink to get something this tangible to take with them, and to know that in the future they're going to be getting perhaps material to add to this, or they can add their own material. We've left space for them to take notes. Some of this material coincided with overhead projected material that they could follow along, and particularly heavy duty topics like copyright. That's a hot topic and generated a great deal of interest on their part. We provided coffee breaks like we do here. This is our mentality, I guess, is coffee breaks. And our hosts were often providing space for lunch for us. We had pretty good attendance. We set it up for a group of 30 or 35 as a manageable group. We had anywhere from 10 to 20 at a time. And we had a wide variety of institutions represented, public libraries and university libraries and historical societies and documentary heritage people.
1 minute.
Yes.
1 minute.
Oh, yes, okay. so what we've got is a notebook with sections devoted to the collections, care, access, glossary, and then miscellaneous information. Richard Warren gave us permission to reprint his two articles on storage and handling. The glossary in here was lifted from the AAA planning study. We're making use of some of our very own materials, which made sense to us. There's information in the miscellaneous section on websites and sources for storage materials, record sleeves, and so forth. There's a great deal of material in here. I hope if you want to look at this, I have a copy. The Education Committee, Sarah Velez, has a copy. She attended one of the workshops. And Nancy Seeger has a copy now. So I don't know if they're carrying them around with them. But if you'd like to look at this, please feel free to. And please make suggestions, because this is now an ARSC product. And we hope it gets wide use. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Sue. The next speaker will be Brenda Nelson Strauss, who will talk about the retention of materials related to sound recordings.
I'm taking a slightly different approach here. First, I'd like to explain that my role is possibly a little different than most of you because I consider myself to be more of a corporate archivist, and my collection is more of a corporate one. And that means that one of my primary missions is to collect and preserve all institutional records of historical, legal, and evidential value. So that instead of going out and collecting, most of the collecting we do is done internally. And let me just briefly say that I'm going to mention records throughout this presentation. I'm not talking about sound recordings. I'm talking about the intellectual records. This gives us an opportunity to do a lot of proactive collecting, and we do that in two different ways. First of all, we try to initiate what we call documentation strategies. These are ways that we actively seek to document certain events of importance, such as ensuring that significant lectures are taped, or we might ensure that certain concerts are taped to the extent that we're able to do that. Or we might see that certain events are photographed, oral histories, things of that nature. But what I'm going to mostly talk about today is another method of proactive collecting, which is really records management. And in records management, we developed retention schedules to determine which ongoing series of records in each department are going to be retained and for what duration, be it 2 years, 7 years, or permanently, in which case those materials would come to the archives. For example, within our operations department, they generate some of the most complex records and some of the records that you're most familiar with. Because some of the ongoing record series involve touring, auditions, hall and orchestra schedules, payroll records for musicians, contracts for musicians, rotation files, and media files, including radio, TV, and recording. And for each of these different series, we assign a recommended retention period, as well as weeding guidelines. For instance, we're going to keep summary information and throw out some of the supplementary stuff. Well, we were working on our own CSO discography with Don Tate. Not only did we find significant gaps within our materials in some of these series, but we also began to reconsider some of the retention schedules for certain records. For example, when you think of commercial recordings, it probably seems obvious that you would permanently retain record company contracts and correspondence and recording session payrolls. That's really a no-brainer. But what might be less obvious for permanent retention, we discovered, were rotation schedules. If you're not familiar with the rotations, the members of the orchestra rotate weekly. So these tell you who was playing what position. Also, hall schedules for session times, and maybe even to go after some anecdotes about recording sessions through oral histories, which we've done. Concerning radio broadcasts of live concerts, it seemed obvious to us that we would collect concert programs, which is a record of the repertoire performed, also broadcast writers and other applicable contracts. But less obvious here, and also important to collect, we discovered would be the rotation schedules and the weekly payroll, because these are really the only record of who actually performed on this concert. And the orchestra program throughout the year just gives the permanent roster of the orchestra, but it doesn't, within any given week there are substitutes, there are people on sabbatical, so it doesn't really tell you who's playing on this program or who's playing, people might ask, who's playing principal horn in that work? And we discovered this was really the only record that we had. So this led us to the conclusion that if a performance is fixed in a recording, certain series such as rotation schedules are no longer really as ephemeral as we thought, but they must be retained permanently or at least as long as the recording exists. These records will yield important information, especially if these broadcasts are released to the public, either commercially or through special premiums. For instance, some of you are familiar with the Radiothon CDs that we issue every year from the archives as a fundraising. As more and more orchestras begin to issue their own recordings or license this broadcast material or archival recordings to commercial companies, this information then becomes crucial for its payroll information as well as for the other data that it yields. As at present, we've been training these retention schedules with Bridget Carr at the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and together we hope to establish some recommended guidelines that other orchestras can follow. And we also plan to work with the Society of American Archivists Performing Arts Roundtable to disseminate these schedules more widely so that other orchestras and performing arts organizations don't need to reinvent the wheel, because we all, of course, have limited resources, and we both spent really a couple years, you know, trading things back and forth to try to establish these guidelines. We see this project as a logical extension of a survey that was conducted by New York Philharmonic archivist Barbara Haas in the late 80s, where she surveyed all of the orchestras to see which records they were actually retaining and which were most likely to be retained permanently. But that was really just a survey, and it didn't establish any guidelines, nor did it really make any recommendations as to retention periods. So we're hoping that this work will help to ensure that information of importance for discographical research will be retained by performing arts organizations. And that's it.
Thank you very much, Brenda. the final paper will be on preservation standards by Jerry Gibson, read by Ted Sheldon.
First, I need to let you know that read by needs to be interpreted very loosely. I'm going to kind of paraphrase and shorten in the interest of time. I believe that LC's legal counsel has contacted Vince Pilote regarding the equity issue of the time allowed for this paper, which is why he's not here right now. At any rate, Jerry sends his regards. As you know, some of you know, he and Emily experienced a very serious auto accident in France a little over a year ago. The repercussions continue. While he and I were in Munich 3 weeks ago, he learned that his wife had suffered a series of strokes, and he went straight home. And that is in large measure why he's not here, and I am. So he sends his regrets that he is not here, and what you're stuck with is me. If this presentation had been made, the topic of this presentation is standards in audio preservation. If this presentation had been made at the time ARS compiled and published its 1987 audio preservation, a planning study, it could have been done in 10 minutes, for there were virtually no clearly identifiable standards for audio preservation. The good news is that today, in large part because of the 1987 study, and because of the active work and effort of many ARSC members, this has changed significantly. The bad news is that this increase means that I cannot possibly do justice to all related standards in 10 minutes. Thus, I'll give you a brief summary of what I remember are the principal concerns of the group. You may ask why standards are important to you. To me, the answer is simple. These documents identify and provide the very best scientifically identified information, materials, and or procedures on how to carry out your work. I do want to emphasize the phrase scientifically identified. Standards are based on science in this field. They are not based on anybody's opinion. They're based on science. And in the adjudication process of a standard, the science is the bedrock, and if you can't find science to support something, you don't put it in a standard. You no longer have to rely on hearsay, expensive trial and error, most often with the error not showing up until many years later, or the oft-times self-serving misinformation provided by salespeople. Another important standard, aspect of standards is that they offer peer-reviewed methods for determining such things as life expectancy of media. So the next time you're told that such materials as optical discs, including CD-ROMs, CDRs, CD-MOs, will live X years, ask if they've used the standards developed by the joint work of the Audio Engineering Society and the American National Standards Institute. If they say yes, ask to see the documentation. If they really follow the AES ANSI procedures, they'll probably be happy to provide the documentation. If the answer is no, ask why you should believe their claims. There are similar tests for film photographic materials from ANSI, and the joint ANSI-AES work is exploring the development of a standard for determining the life expectancy of magnetic tape. That is turning out to be a real bear. From my experience, the standards likely to be of most interest to ARS members are those concerned with the storage, packaging, and handling of sound recordings and other AV material that are frequently a part of an audio collection. There are now AES and or ANSI standards for these issues. Storage of polyester-based magnetic tapes, life testing of optical discs, and related standards for photographs and film transparencies. In addition, under development are a wide range of standards covering other issues, for example, concerned with audio and related AV preservation, including transfer procedures, test tones and signals, digital interfaces and connectors, loudspeaker and video monitor evaluation and or alignment, physical specifications for such items as tape reels, dimensions of audio cassettes, technical specifications for different types of video signals, metadata for digital audio, still and moving images, alignment of tape equipment. I'm sure you get the point. There's much in process. In conclusion, Jerry indicates that he'd like to point you to a couple of websites, which I can provide the names of later, but for the purposes of the record, the Audio Engineering Society has a website at www.aes.org. That is absolutely rational. If you thought about how to put together the signature for an Audio Engineering Society website, you'd do that. Then put a forward cross hatch and standards. And in fact, when you get on the www.aes.org, one of the little graphics is standards, and you just click on that. ANSI also has a website, and in fact, it's an online catalog at web.web.ansi.org/public/std_info.html. That's a long one. And lastly, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers has a website, www.smpte.org. I could, if I had time, which I don't, is that right?
Correct.
But since LC's legal counsel is involved, there are a number of standards that Jerry has provided in a list here, and I'm happy to get this photocopied and provide it to any of those who might be interested.
Yeah, maybe we could get some copies made and put it on the table at the registration. Okay, thank you very much, Ted. So at this point, I'm going to open the meeting for general discussion. We have a microphone down here, which is pointed, of course, in the wrong direction. But don't let that stop you. We'd appreciate it if you would come down and to make your comment rather than standing in the audience. Excellent job, Ben. But I'd appreciate it if you would come down and make your comments from here rather than from your chair, simply to make sure that everybody can hear. This is a relatively small hall, but it's still not necessarily easy. And I would like to, yes, come on. And don't raise your hands, just come on down and you can sort of form a line down here and one after another.
Wendy Sistrunk, University of Missouri, Kansas City. And very fine presentations, I think. I was very interested in what you saying, Garrett, about maybe providing a clearinghouse of information. I think we can use the web in a much more aggressive way. Perhaps one of the things I was talking about with Sam this morning was, wouldn't it be great to have some sort of list or clearinghouse of what collections are where. I mean, we can all look on various reference sources that are out of date, perhaps, or go to round tables where people come up and say, oh yeah, we just acquired this collection, or we're cataloging this collection. Sometimes you don't necessarily want to make things public, but it would be wonderful to know what archives, what collections all of them have. And I don't know if SAA has this sort of information as well, but anyway, I just think that might be some one of the things that maybe AA could work on or help out.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, my name is Stephen Barr. I'm from Oshawa, Ontario, and those of you who are here from 78L, of course, know me or know of me. And I was just wondering to what extent is any consideration being given, because it's certainly what I would help out insofar as possible, and it's sort of my area of expertise, but to standardizing some sort of standard that could be used from which we could build various discographic digital cataloging programs so that they could at least speak to one another. And insofar as it would obviously have to include what already exists, insofar as they could, you know, it would have to be sort of a taken from looking at all of these and pull out sort of a standard thing to where they what they have in common, starting with AVRL and working with through all of the major institutional cataloging programs and possibly some of the commercial ones as well. And I just wondered to what extent, if you were working in that area, if you had considered working in that area.
Okay. That's a good question. First of all, we have not considered working in that area because you're talking about basically discography, and the next session after the next session, we'll have a discussion about discography. But as far as actually trying to work out some sort of standard for programs that hold discographic information, it's something that could be done, but you know, it's generally an individual discographer's work.
Well, I was also thinking in terms of not only discographies, but for catalogs of various large collections, personal or institutional, to sort of standardize so that you could look at the catalog, say, for the New York Public Library, and that would be able to relate in some way to the one for the Library of Congress, mm-hmm. which in turn would relate to AVRL, which would in turn relate to my collection right. insofar as it's cataloged, so that there would be some sort of idea of what basic framework you could use and then put your own bells and whistles on it, but they could still all relate to one another.
Actually I encourage you to look at those sorts of catalogs in terms of how to put together information for a discography. But yes, as a matter of fact, there has been a fair amount of work done at standardizing library catalogs, and it has been going on for 30 years at least. As a result of that, now you can get into the New York Public Library catalog or the Library of Congress catalog or most any university's catalog and many other catalogs, library catalogs, using very much the same sort of interface. There's a protocol, there's a standard that's been developed to assist these various catalogs, these machine-driven catalogs, to work together, called a Z3950. And that by itself has sort of helped make a more standard catalog.
Where do you get the Z3950? See, where do you get a chance to look at Z3950?
Well, the information, that's available through NISO, I believe.
Oh, it's ANSI.
Oh, ANSI, okay. Which is, yeah, go ahead.
American National Standards Institute has an arcane system for organizing information related to standards. The area for bibliographic control is Z39. So if you went to a library to consult standards documents that define what's called the MARC record, the machine readable bibliographic record, you'd want to go to a collection of ANSI standards and ask a librarian or a consultant there to help you find what you want in the area of Z39.
Steve Smolian, I'd just like to elaborate on the same issue. Is there nobody here from AVRL who's active in it who should be standing in this mic instead of myself? Yes, then why don't you come up and talk, Sam?
Clutch it. Clutch it.
This is what is called grasping an opportunity.
Isn't it nipper time now? Actually, I think there's going to be an AVRL report is on the agenda for the business meeting. But you all know that what the AVRL is that this, you don't know? Well, let me, I know, is this the time to do this? Because
yeah, you've got about 2 minutes, how's that?
It's more time, okay, well then I can talk pretty fast if I try real hard. Kurt Nock, in his business and in his contacts with collectors, has discovered something that many of us knew and suspected, which was basically all the people home, getting away from their families and their basements and putting their collections and creating discographies on DBase programs or FileMaker programs or WordPerfect or whatever. And Kurt had a dream, which was to compile these into a union discography, or what Kurt called a labelography. I shouldn't call it a union discography because it didn't relate to holdings, but it was a way to accumulate all these discographies into what Kurt hoped to be a national discography. Now, to jump ahead a few years, he harvested a lot of data, it got sent to him, and there is a team of volunteers working on this. Elwood McKee is the head of volunteers, and we'll be talking to you later about that when Chris Hopkins comes. Is Chris here, by the way? Well, Chris has, to make a long story short, Kurt's dream got formalized when ARSC adopted it as an ARSC project. Chris Hopkins, who is the programmer of Sound Librarian, which is an excellent, you know, catalog your collection at home program, which has in and of itself has had a lot of input from ARSC members in the creation of that database. I know Steve, among others, and Chris is an expert Access, Microsoft Access, and Visual Basic programmer, and has been charged with coming up with the routines to enable us to sort of dedupe and edit all this data that Kurt has amassed. The Library of Congress commissioned Chris to convert its portion of the Regler Deutsch data, that is the data that was created by the AAA committee nearly 20 years ago, and to put that into an AVRL type format and that could be added to AVRL and other institutions who are part of the original Regler Deutsch Index project may do the same. To get to the end, Chris is nearing completion, we hope, this is why I asked whether he was here, of this of the routines to the algorithms to dedupe and edit the system. The idea of this, of the AVRL being Z39.50 compatible is an interesting one that I hadn't thought of, and I think once we get this, right now we're sort of toning down the ambition of it and get the thing going and get something real, and then we'll start again by thinking about how it could expand. One of Kurt's notions is actually to make it, you know, a national database and then an international database. But for now, we just want to get a beta version out, which will be on CD-ROM. It will have a capability where with Sound Librarian, you could use it to catalog your own personal collections, maybe, and then also add data to the AVRL for original cataloging you create. You know, God knows, maybe we... can give us an update. But this idea of Z39.50, which is basically a language that can that other archives, like the machine-readable catalog, mark structure, that you know, where indexes are compiled in such a way that you can sort of search lots of different databases at once, or lots of different databases with the same search commands, could be applied to AVRL if AVRL gets put up on the web. Now, that's not, you know, in the immediate plans. The immediate plan is to get a CD-ROM that's compatible with Sound Librarian, so that you'll be able to see the data for maybe at least 500,000 78s, if not more, because a lot of people who have, you know, given us print discographies have given us the permission to convert there, such as Dick Spotswood, who I think is here. His 7-volume discography will be part of AVRL. You know, once we finish conversion, there are 2 people working on that. That's the main reason a lot of us are, you know, looking forward to this meeting this weekend to meet and sort of get this thing to the next step.
Thank you very much. Are there any other comments or questions? Okay, well, we're almost to the end of our time, I think. I'd like to kind of wrap this up and thank you all for coming to this session. And as you think about things that you would like to be involved in, or you think that of things that the Associated Audio Archivists ought to be working on, basically focused on, you know, institutional things, because that's still basically our focus. But, you know, that covers almost anything from preservation to cataloging to whatever. And these are all things that not only are of value to an institution, but they're also of value to individual collectors, because you all have collections that need to be developed and maintained in some good way. And the standards that we develop and have worked on, the kinds of things that we've been involved with, are things I think that are very relevant to almost any collector of sound recordings. So thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you, Sue.